Hi guys, thanks for joining me for episode one of the Lipstick Gang podcast. I'm not going to lie, I'm both crazy excited but also nervous as hell. This is a completely new platform and endeavour for me. Everything I'm doing for this podcast is pretty much self-taught from frantic Googling and watching YouTube videos. But the feedback and response I've been getting so far has been so supportive and super positive, which just makes me feel like I'm on the right path. So just a little shout out to all of you. Thank you everyone for your amazing and continued support. And on the theme of positivity, I am so excited that my first guest on the podcast is my dear friend, Sabrina Sikora. Now, if you don't know Sabrina, she is a model, photographer, an ambassador for independent, sustainable and female-led brands, as well as a mum of two little ones, Adam and Iva. But she is also such a cheerleader and uplifting individual who just radiates positivity to everyone that she meets. She and I have known each other for 8 years. We first met in Hong Kong back in 2012, before either of us had any little ones running around. Actually, during the episode, I revealed to Sabrina a really weird coincidence that actually connected us way before we even met. And in the episode, we chat about growing up in Macon, Georgia, and how she got her start in the world of modeling, signing with Elite Modeling Agency when she was just 14. She shares her experiences growing up in front of the lens, how she transitioned to being behind the camera too, as well as the importance of goal setting that she learned from her mum and continues with her own children today. Her mantra of all forward motion counts, no matter how small a step in the right direction, is something that I think a lot of us can use, especially during these times when it can get a little difficult to see the wood for the trees. As a parent who has been in a very image-conscious industry that wasn't always the most uplifting for her, Sabrina really emphasizes the importance of being kind to yourself and shining a light on others to lift them up too. Oh, and we also talk about her experience doing traditional Chinese confinement after giving birth to both of her kids and how similar it is to lockdown life, as well as the things she does to give herself a boost and to focus on the positives. But I don't want to give away too much, so let's just get into the episode. And here is my interview with Sabrina Sikora. Everyone, welcome to the Lipstick Gang podcast. I'm your host, Nessa, and with me today is the wonderful Sabrina Sikora. Sabrina Sikora or Sabrina Sikora Demenge? I always forget which you go by.
Well, it's kind of like Superman and Clark Kent in my personal I use my married name, but I came up modeling as kind of one word, Sabrina Sikora, and that's how everybody knew me. So I feel like in the Insta world and website wise, it's Sabrina Sikora.
It's definitely good with the alliteration. I feel like it's a good, like, sort of, it is, you didn't even need to come up with a stage name. It's just perfect the way it is.
Thanks, Mom.
Cool. So we have been friends for a number of years, but obviously to some of our listeners and viewers today, you're probably a new face. So why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? Who are you? What do you do?
Oh, good Lord. there's a lot of chapters here. So I'm Sabrina Sikora. I'm 36-year-old mom of two. I grew up as a model and started doing photography as well, kind of in my late teens, early 20s, and have been a model slash photographer pretty much my whole life now. And basically, if it involves fashion, I am there smiling, asking to be a part of it. So that's pretty much it.
I love how you say that you grew up as a model, because I think that if I were to describe you to people, that is probably, that is one of the descriptive terms that I would use, because you have literally been in the industry, I think, since you were 13. I remember you saying before, like, you were really, really young.
I decided I wanted to be a model when I was 10, when I did the Sears Model Club. So, do you know Sears?
So we don't have Sears in the UK. And obviously in Hong Kong growing up, we didn't have Sears, but I do know Sears obviously through American television. It's a department store, correct?
It is. And they were kind of known for their like heavy appliances, like washers and dryers, not so much for their modeling team. But they had a lady come in, and it was kind of like summertime, and my mom was trying to get me involved in classes, and they had a lady come in, and she taught us how to runway walk and put on makeup, and I was completely obsessed. And so from there, we wrote letters. My mom helped me write letters to all of the stores in the mall, and I would go stand in their windows for like a 20% discount on their item. I like not even a dress for free. Like I would just get a discount. And I did that until I was probably 14 or so, and started shooting with anyone that would shoot me, whatever, have me in front of their lens, and started looking for an agency. And I was 12, and I got turned down by Elite at 12 because I was too young, turned down again by Elite when I was 13 because I was too skinny. And then I signed with Elite when I was 14.
That's amazing. But I mean, because you're from Macon, Georgia, which I don't know very much about the South in America, other than stuff that you have taught me in our 8 years of friendship. But I mean, tell me about growing up there, because I'm imagining it, and this might be really, really wrong, but I'm imagining it as relatively rural, certainly compared to, I guess, where I'm from, or where kind of we both in our mutual cities where we both live now. So how does someone from Macon, Georgia, I guess, go to then signing with Elite Model Agency, which is like one of the biggest agencies in the world?
Well, that answer's easy. That was my mom. She was she was there 100% supporting me. But yeah, Macon, it was an awesome place to grow up. I moved from a very small town called Barnesville. I moved to Macon when I was 5. And so I was able to stay in the same school system while I was there, which I think was really nice and like key to my upbringing, because the friends that you made when you were 4 years old, 4 or 5 years old, like you had them all the way through high school and college. So even though I was able, as I got older, to travel and fly around, I still had this like amazing core group of girlfriends that I'd known, you know, since we were just knee high to a grasshopper. and you know, Macon is, it's the heart of Georgia. It is, well, when I was there, it was about 120,000 people. So sizable enough to where, you know, you did run into your friends at the grocery store, but it also, there was, you know, tons of different schools. So you always had somebody new to meet. And I got involved in pageants when I was there, and really involved in community service while I was there as well. And what was great was that once I got involved in the pageants and started kind of having my name out there, then, and the modeling started kind of coming up as well, people were really, really supportive. Like the newspaper would do articles, and you know, TV cameras would show up when I was having like a send off when I went to go on a modeling competition, you know, something like that. And so it really felt like the city was there with me, and the people in my high school were really supportive. I went to college there as well, at Wesleyan College. And they were extremely supportive. So even letting me, you know, take time off during my senior year to go and travel to Miami. And then with college, they allowed me to do a semester, my like working internship semester. I was able to count modeling as that and live in New York. So the schools, they kind of saw the big picture. And not a lot of other, you know, 14, 15, 16-year-old girls had huge contracts. So it was kind of a special, unique job that they were able to see and work with me, which was nice.
That's amazing. I think that, I guess not a lot of people could probably argue that they had the same sort of support or the community kind of behind them in that sense, especially from such a young age as well. I'm interested, like, obviously you said you kind of always knew that you wanted to get into modeling, but the pageant route, I'm fascinated about. Please tell me more about the pageants. Where did you compete? How many titles have you won? Do we need to start have you added these titles into your resume? I mean, I need to hear more about the pageant life.
Okay, so same kind of thing. It was around like the age of 12 where you're kind of like, I've got the summer off. I've got nothing to do. I wasn't a sporty kid. I was like long and awkward and gangly and just, you know, I couldn't run or jump or I'd fall over myself. I kind of looked like Bambi on ice when I tried any athletics. So my mom was constantly like looking for me to do something. And she kind of came across an ad in the paper one day and was like, hey, there's a pageant this weekend for Young Miss Macon. You want to go do it. And, you know, in the South, like girls are raised from birth in the pageant community. So for me to like walk in as a 12-year-old and be like, hey, y'all, you know, just having no idea how to walk, having no idea how to interview, what to say, anything was interesting, to say the least. I remember my mom sitting in the audience at my first pageant as I wore a green velvet shift dress with black chunky velvet heels.
Oh my goodness.
And I was waving like this as I came out on stage.
That is a look.
It was pretty amazing. But the lady next to my mom was like, "Oh, honey, is this her first pageant?" She's like, "Yes." And she's like, "She'll learn." Mom was like, "What does that even mean?"
She'll learn.
It came at a time where there was a bit of a backlash against kind of the over pageanty girls, and they were looking for something a bit more natural. And it just so happened that I walked in that day having no idea what I was doing and was as natural as they came. And I ended up winning my very first pageant. Granted, there were only four girls in it, so chances were pretty good. But
don't take away from your victory. Don't downplay it.
Thank you. But yeah, and I came home and called my grandma and told her I won, you know, the title of Young Miss Macon. And all of a sudden, you know, you're sitting there, I think I was 12 and I had a crown on my head and that was it. It was like, okay, mom, what's the next one? And
wow. So you just like caught the bug really early then.
I think so. I mean, it is an amazing opportunity for young people to stand in front of a crowd, which can be quite intimidating, to learn public speaking, to be interviewed by adults on current events, which again is not something you're doing in school. It also allows you to really invest in the community service aspects of it, and you can earn scholarship money. So kind of all of those things, you know, added up to being like, wow, this is a really interesting way to go forward. And we, growing up, we didn't have a lot of money at all. And so you still had to buy your own dresses and, you know, you had to get sponsorships. So to get those sponsorships, mm-hmm. I would go and I would like clean up trash in front of a business, or I would show up as a princess to the kids' birthday party to like pay for, you know, the ad space and in the brochures and things that they were, the pamphlets that they were handing out. And then also to pay for the dresses and the swimsuits and the evening gowns and the coaches, the shoes, everything, all of it. The headshot that you had to have, you know, the makeup training for the special stage makeup, learning how to sing because, oh my heavens, not on stage, which will never happen again.
Oh, I was going to ask for a rendition of Star Spangled Banner right now, but maybe we should just... Maybe next time we'll say something for our lovely listeners.
But yeah, so it was great. As far as titles go, I did the Triple Crown in Macon. It was Young Miss Macon, Teen Miss Macon, and then Miss Macon, which goes on to the Miss Georgia, Miss America system. And I also did the USA system, which goes on to Miss Universe. So
wow.
So I did Miss USA system, but the highest I went in that, I think I was second runner up to Miss Georgia USA.
I mean, that is still an accolade in and of itself.
I was pretty excited about, to be honest, because that one, that just felt really good. I felt really confident in how I'd gone on stage, and yeah, and the interviews were always my strong suit. So I always felt like I had something special going into the pageants, which was quite nice.
That's really interesting because I think that, I mean, all the detail that you've just gone into is, I think, so much more than what people realize go into that. And I guess from a certain standpoint, there is definitely the stereotype of pageanting. You know, I think that there's arguments out there that people would say it's vapid or it's, you know, it doesn't take very much to go into it. It's just about standing there and looking pretty, which I guess, you know, people would still say the same thing probably about modeling as well. There are these stereotypes out there that it doesn't actually take work. And I'm just absolutely intrigued to know, what is your response or standpoint when people kind of come to you and say like, oh, well, it's just, you just stand there and smile, and you don't, you know, it's like the Miss Congeniality stereotype of like, world peace.
Yeah. Yeah. World peace. You know what? You can just stand there and smile if you like, but you're not going to win. And you learn that, you know, it's so much more than that. You have to go into a pageant with a platform, which is something that you believe in and something that you're working towards and something that if you win, you're going to work on that year. And mine was environmental awareness. And I had done a lot of community service in cleaning up the town and doing like the Nike Reuse Issue program, planting trees, just had been doing it my whole life, Christmas tree recycling, and just tons and tons of different things. And you build up your community service hours through it. You're also working on your interview skills, which just comes in handy for life. Today, I am a bit more casual than I used to be, where I used to stand up prim and proper and give my.
You're very polished still. Answers. You're still very polished.
Thank you. Old habits die hard. I think I made a lot of great friendships through it as well. I mean, I still talk to some of the girls that I did pageants with daily. I mean, thank you, social media, for that. But it's a great opportunity to meet incredible business leaders in your area as well, because through these sponsorships, you're then getting all sorts of contacts and creating a network and kind of bringing people up with you, and they're helping you. And it's, I think that's where I learned that you all come up together. And I think you hear a lot about, you know, as far as the stereotypes go, the backstabbing. And I never really found that to be true. I always found that the girls would offer tips and help calm each other backstage, and we'd be laughing backstage and kind of trying to work through the nerves. And then you'd go outside and you'd just do the best you can. And you could always tell the girls on stage who had it. As soon as they hit the stage, there was like a light that just shone on them. And those were the ones that you could just learn from immediately. But eventually, I feel like I had been doing them for about 8 years. And the modeling at this point, I was 21 or so, and I was living in New York, and it was just starting to happen. And it just felt like it was time to kind of close that chapter and move on to the next one. Although one of my best memories of pageants was I was the Cherry Blossom Queen in Macon, Georgia. And the Cherry Blossom Festival is massive there. They have 100,000 cherry trees. And the whole city goes pink for 10 days. And I had to basically go to as many events as possible. There's over 500 events at the Cherry Blossom Festival, and loads of them are free. So it like really, really includes the community. And so I got to be the Cherry Blossom Queen and have four lovely princesses that we all traveled around together, and they flew me to different cities to go represent Macon. And it was just a really nice time to kind of, you know, do something special in my hometown. And that was when I was 17. You only had one shot at getting that crown. And so I was really excited to be able to do that one. And I still have my pink crown up on a little pillow on the bookcase in Vermont. And
that's amazing.
My daughter loves the pictures because I have bright blonde hair, curls, and a pink dress on. And she said I look like Barbie. So.
Oh, bless. That's adorable. It must be so nice to have memories like that, that not only are just memories of you kind of learning your craft and kind of going on to that next chapter in your life, but then equally like stuff that really ties you to your hometown, which I guess, again, you know, you moved away relatively young. I mean, from my perspective, I guess relatively young, you know, you were modeling internationally from such a young age. And like you just kind of mentioned, I really would love to learn more in terms of, you know, your next chapter, which is obviously you said just now, like you were in New York, early 20s, obviously living the dream by the sounds of it, doing all your modeling. What are some of the highlights from that chapter of your life? Because that we would say is probably when you really, for lack of a better term, blossomed.
Oh, you make it sound so sweet. It's funny that you say that, because I said I was gawky and gangly, which was very true. You know, I was doing these pageants and I was like 5'11", 6 foot tall and in heels, and just really standing head and shoulders above the rest. And I remember going to my first runway show in Atlanta. I think it was for Tommy Hilfiger. And I walked backstage and everyone looked like me. They were all 5'11 and the same size as me with big feet. And I was pretty much the biggest of the group. And I remember them just saying like, oh, honey, like your pants are short. Here's where you go to buy pants. Oh, honey, you can't find big shoes. Well, this is the store you go to buy shoes. And all of a sudden it was like, I just kind of like found my flock, you know, like fabulous flamingos. And, I walked out to my mom, who obviously I couldn't drive anywhere. My mom drove me everywhere to every casting and every shoot. And I just came out and I was like, Mom, there are others. And it felt like such a special moment because I'd like found my people. I'm like, Mommy, I'm not weird. Look, they can't find pants either. But yeah, through the modeling. So I started in Atlanta and I think you kind of, you know, you have your look, right? And for me at that time, I was 6 foot tall and a size 2. So for me, runway was where it started. And I was really blessed to do a lot of awesome runway shows at a very young age, which was just mind blowing because I was still, you know, the girl from Macon, Georgia. So to be walking for like Chanel and Herrera and Valentino was just next level. I'd never seen these clothes up close. I didn't shop at those stores. So to have them on, and then also they're made for models' bodies. So to have clothing on that fit was like its own thing. Was pretty incredible, and getting to see these people that I had only ever seen in magazines was just very surreal at that age. From there I traveled. I went to Miami when I was 17 and lived there for a while. I went to Milan when I was 17, started going to New York at 16, was starting to go to LA at 15. Did Shanghai but New York for me is where it pretty much, that was my fit. I did a lot in Atlanta, obviously, because that was close to home. And so I would go travel to New York, travel back and forth, do summers in New York, come back to Atlanta for school. And that's where like I hit my stride and kind of found my path.
Yeah, I can imagine as a young woman in your early 20s and kind of really embarking on the start of your career, that must have been such an exciting time for you.
It was, and it felt like I was off and doing something special and like really checking off the goals. I always, my mom was really big on creating a goal list every year, you know, and it was one, it was signed with an agency. And then when I signed with the agency, you scratch that off and it was like, get a paid job. Doesn't matter what the job is. Yeah, I think my first job was like a sale flyer in the newspaper, but it paid. And so like we scratched that goal off, and then it was like, get in a magazine, get on the cover of a magazine, get in a runway show, get in a, you know, top labeled runway show, do New York Fashion Week. And so as we would scratch off the goal, like the goal would get a bit loftier. And I still do that. We have goal lists for the kids on the refrigerator. You know, I still have mine, my goal list. And I think that's really important because it keeps you moving forward, even if that forward step is very small. I like always have said, or at least since my son was born and he woke up every 45 minutes for a year, all forward motion counts. You remember those days? All forward motion counts. Like no matter how small it is, you're moving forward, you're checking something off your list. And that felt very important. And New York, living there, being signed with a top 10 agency, that was very important on my list. And you know, getting forward. And I found out once I was in New York that runway in New York was lovely, but at this point I was a size 4 and a bigger 4.
I mean, a size 4 at the height that you are as well. You're 6 foot tall, like you said, and you're wearing heels for a lot of most of the time anyway when you're on shoots and during runway. Is insane to think that that was not the ideal, I guess, for runway.
It's, yeah, and I think times are changing, right? It's so much more inclusive now, and I feel like I can finally exhale because, honestly, I was ducking in. you know, when I was naturally a size 2-4, runway was a great fit. I didn't have to think about it. It was easy. But as I started getting older and not even getting curvy, I'm still quite straight up and down, but just becoming an adult, you know, you know, like I was a big 4, almost a 6. And so runway work didn't work for me as well. I was always worried about fitting into pants, like going on a casting and having someone hand me a pair of pants was like panic attack inducing. Cause it's like, oh my God, what if these don't fit? And even worse, what if they put a tape measure around my butt? And even worse, what if they then call the agency and I get yelled at? Like, so being able to kind of transition from runway, which again is the adrenaline rush you get from runway, it's like nothing else. But I found out totally by accident that I make a pretty good parts model. And parts modeling is something incredibly special that a lot of people don't think about. Even behind you, there's a hand on the wall. but it's in every single ad for jewelry, for lipstick, for cosmetics, when people are drinking something, when they're eating something, when they're, you know, opening a magazine, when they're holding a book on the cover of the Twilight books, when she's holding an apple, that's a parts model. You know, all the tech gadgets that are coming out, you need a finger to swipe the phone. That's a parts model. And I ended up signing with an agency in New York called Parts. You know, they really hit the hits.
Does what it says on the tin.
I loved that because you knew exactly what you were getting. And she was incredible. I walked into her door and she basically had a checklist in front of her and had me stand up, spin around, kind of show her all the parts. And she just went down the list and was like, hair, eyes, face, lips, neck, back, bum, whatever it was, legs, not feet. Like, scratch that one out. And basically put a list together. And as I was on other shoots, she's like, okay, we'll see if they can do a couple of shots of your hands while you're there. And I'm like, okay. And so I'd be on a regular shoot. And at the end, I'd just say, oh, can you get just a couple, of shots here? And before I knew it, more than half of my bookings were parts bookings. And they ended up, what I loved about it was that one, there were less people on the casting, so you had better odds of getting the booking. Two, you rarely had to try on pants. That really
Or shoes.
Or shoes. Exactly. Size 12s and shoes. It's just not lovely. And then also was that the clients were higher profile. They had bigger budgets. The budget was typically twice that of my regular day rate because it was specialized. So I was able to go on set with these top name clients and have an amazing day doing something that I felt really confident in. And like that in itself built you up, right?
Yes, because so I know that there is a fun fact about you is that at one stage you were the world's highest paid lip model. Is that correct? Mm.
I was, yes.
Which I have. So I have a really funny serendipitous moment that was such a precursor to us becoming friends and meeting. And I'm sure I've told you this in private before, but for the listeners, I would love to share it again. So on your website, you have your portfolio and you have different photos from ad campaigns that you have done in Cosmopolitan, stuff for Tom Ford, like loads of different brands, loads of different media companies. And there was one that you did for Cointreau that yes. were your lips. And they were kind of like an ombre color, sort of, I think there was one that was like a purplish and green, I think. And there was one that was kind of like a real beautiful, vibrant, sunset-y kind of aesthetic. And I actually, when I was a teenager, I remember cutting out clips from magazines, putting collages together, putting stuff on my wall. And I had your lips on my wall before you and I met. Isn't that wild?
Oh, I love it. Oh, my mom calls those God winks.
Oh, I love that.
Where like, yeah, there's just a little something special in the universe looking at you.
A little bit of fate. Yeah. I know. It's so funny. I need to, next time I go back to my parents' house, I'm sure there are probably not the stuff that was on the wall, but definitely like scrapbooks and collage books that I know are somewhere hidden away in the storage. And I need to go and fish them out because I'm convinced that there is going to be photos of you from like ads that you've done for Cosmo, which is just so wild that and every time I see that ad or every time I see those photos on your portfolio, on your website, it just gives me so much joy because it was like the stars aligned and we were connected before we were even friends and before we met, which I just love. I thought it was just a really serendipitous moment.
Oh, I love that. That was one of those shoots that kind of the stars aligned on my end as well. I wasn't actually booked to be the girl in the campaign. I was booked to be the test model. And so we spent 4 8-hour days testing the lip color combinations that they were going to shoot over, I think, a 2-day period. And so I was just the test girl. But then it ended up to be where I just worked with them for 4 days. I knew what to expect. We got on well. I was always a very, good model on set. I've learned through Southern upbringing and pageants and modeling that you have a smile on your face, you come and you are helpful and you try to add joy, where you can. And so they ended up canceling the model they booked for the campaign. And I remember them on the phone kind of in the back office being like, oh, can we just keep her for the next few days if she's available? And I'm like over there, I'm like, Sam available. Yes. Yes. and that booking was so great because it opened so many doors as well, which was really nice. And I think that booking allowed me after that to work for Maybelline and Max Factor and Revlon and Tom Ford and just really like take it to another level. And so it was quite a special moment where just by chance, they were like, oh, well, we've already worked with you for a couple of days. Like we know you. So I love those little moments where you don't even realize like your world is changing and it just does in a blink.
Definitely. So, I mean, that really makes me, it reminds me of a point I definitely wanted to ask you about, which is kind of, I guess, linked to the modeling side of things. But you are one of the sweetest and kindest and most supportive people that I have ever met. You are such a cheerleader for everyone. Genuinely, you're such a cheerleader for everyone. You're effervescent and you're just so positive all the time. And obviously, I think, again, going back to stereotypes, you don't expect someone this beautiful to be that nice. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think people would assume that, people who don't know you, maybe, you know, you're very tall, you're very slim, you're really beautiful, you're very confident, but you're also just so lovely. Why? How did you get so nice?
Oh my goodness. Oh, can I call you back when I'm having a really bad day? That's very sweet. Thank you. I think, one, modeling isn't an uplifting industry, or it wasn't all the time when I was there. You get beaten down quite a lot verbally, just because you're constantly, well, you're comparing yourself to everyone, right? Like, and I'm sure it's a bit different today, and you know, people are more uplifting and more inclusive. But when I was in it wholeheartedly, you know, you go on a casting and you're literally standing in line with 50 other girls who are stunning, and you're in a bikini. And what are you going to do at 19 years old? You're just going to rip yourself apart. Oh my gosh, look at her body. Oh my gosh, look at her stomach. Look at her butt. Look at her hair. Girls do that to themselves anyway. And what I can equate it to is basically whatever you say to yourself in a dressing room, that's what's being said to you by the clients. So if you're thinking when you go try on a swimsuit, like, oh God, my thighs are a bit big, you say that to yourself and it hurts a little bit. But when you're 19 and you go on a casting and you go on 13 castings a day and you're hearing, yes, you're hearing some great things. Of course, there are beautiful, wonderful clients out there. But what do you remember in life? Do you remember all the positivity that happens to you? Or do you remember those little digs that just kind of, you know, like are like thorns in your side? And especially at that age, I don't think you quite know how to process it yet and put it into perspective when you have to pay rent and your rent is, you know, decided upon by how many jobs you're booking, and those jobs are decided upon by the size of your hips, right? So it's, there's perspective is quite lost. But pretty much every part of my body has been picked apart on some level and told what's completely wrong with it and why I'm awful, you know, in some way. And I think you, I don't know if you develop a thick skin. I think you learn, or at least I did, to kind of separate my body, the product, from my person, because I am a product, right? Like, if you don't want my look, you're not going to hire me. So I can't take that personally. I can't be upset about the fact that I'm not a 5'8" size 2 girl, because I will never be that. So at a certain point, you just have to say, I am not what that client was looking for at this moment for this job. Because on another job, on another day, you can walk in and they're like, oh, you're perfect. Why didn't we see you before? And I did. I had clients say every end of the spectrum. And I think you have to learn just to be very kind to yourself, which takes time. I think that takes age as well and healing. It's so much better to be uplifting, because all the models that I met, we were all going through the same thing. We were all hearing the same stuff, no matter how stunningly beautiful you thought they were. They usually had no self-confidence. And I find that to be so interesting, because the models that I met through the industry were so nice and so down to earth, because they knew that, like, this was just, it was kind of a blip in time, and you all have to get through it together, and you all have to support each other. And yeah, you're having a bad day or something, somebody said something hurtful to you, but you just have to keep going, because the next day you're going to have the client that loves you, and like, you're going to get that high again. It was very much a roller coaster. And so you kind of just learn to roll with the punches and, you know, be optimistic about things, because if you're not, then it can be a hurtful industry. But if you're looking forward to the next booking and what the next casting is going to hold, and, you know, who the next person you're going to meet is and what that opportunity is going to be, then you open yourself up to a whole world of chances. And if you say yes to those chances, then you can travel to some amazing places and meet some incredible people and have experiences that not a lot of other people get. You know, it's a pretty magical environment. But you have to be smart about yourself and your body, and you have to be healthy. And being healthy at that age is such a wild thing, because you've never really, I think teens haven't had to be healthy before, right? Like, it's all about just going forward and metabolism and just, you know, you're on the move, you're athletic, you're doing your thing. And I didn't know what healthy was Nobody had ever sat me down and explained that. Like, oh, honey, these are vegetables. No, you don't fry them. I know that you're Southern and you fry your green beans and you fry your okra. And those are delicious, by the way. But like, here's how you cook and here's how to make a healthy meal. And no, you don't have to count your calories. Like, eat fruits and vegetables and yeah, have some carbs. And yeah, you know, if you're old enough, have a drink. Like, put it in balance. You want to have cake? Have a cake. Like, but don't have it every night in secret under the kitchen counter. Like, find your balance. And, you know, I wish at that age somebody had handed me a jump rope and been like, oh, you don't have to spend 3 hours on the elliptical machine after doing, you know, 8 hours of castings. And you can just do this for 20 minutes and like have your day back and you know, be healthy and strong. And I think I value strength so much more now than I ever did.
Yeah.
Like having the strength to pick up my kids and haul them around and haul all of my photography gear around, I value so much more than fitting in a pair of fitted pants. All of my pants now have elastic. I think that if I ever have to suck in again, it will just make me sad. I find that my style is quite glamorous, whatever, lots of accessories and jewelry. I quite view those as armor. But it's relaxed glam. It's if I'm not comfortable, then it's just not going to happen. I'm so tired of sucking in to be somebody else's perfect.
Oh, absolutely. But I find that so, I think you mentioned that before, like the way in which that industry has changed. And I think that obviously you're kind of, you're on the other side of it now as well. You still model, you still work with brands. You do shoots with them both in front of and behind the camera. And what I find really interesting is you were in front of the lens and then you transitioned to behind. Is being a photographer, does that make you a better model? And being a model, has that made you a better photographer?
I don't think it does, actually. I think it makes you more critical, which is not a good thing. Well, as a model, you have to know your angles. So when you're learning to kind of model, the agency had told me, one, watch old movies and see how the women moved. And that was such a big help at being able to move gracefully and having lovely hands and how to put your hands. And then they told me to basically rip out, like you were saying, with your scrapbooks, like rip out the pages in magazines that you find interesting and then look in a mirror and copy that pose. Look at the pose, try to do it. Do it over and over again until you can just hit the expression, hit the look, know exactly how to get that exact thing without having to look at yourself and just knowing what it feels like model down to your toes. So every part of you is included in emoting, right? And into selling that product. Being a photographer has taught me about how much work goes into the prep of the shoot, the actual shoot, and the after, the post-production. Like, it is not just walking on set. I thought that modeling was hard, you know? And yes, you're on your feet. Maybe you're not eating. Maybe you're working through the day and you're not getting fed. You're working in very hot, very cold conditions. Maybe not with some of the nicest people. You're hearing, you know, a lot of it's internal as well with body image issues. But yeah, with the photography, I found it was so much more physical effort than the modeling because I was hauling gear all the time. So there's a lot of the planning and getting all of the people involved because when you look at these shoots and magazines, everybody has to realize there's a team that goes into it. And this is what would blow my mind when I was a kid is, or not so much a kid, but as a model working with younger models because I helped a lot of girls come up and get placed. And, you know, they would compare themselves to the girls in the magazines. And, oh, that would just drive me nuts because there is no comparing yourself to girls in magazines. You know, that is a team that has come together. Someone professional has done her hair and her makeup and has styled her. And she is a model that was booked for that job. Like, she's already in a very small percentage of people to be able to be in that circumstance to get that job. And then you have the whole team of lighting, photographers, photographer assistants, retouchers, like everybody on set making this one image perfect. And when I would see, you know, my friends being like, oh my gosh, look at that picture. I'm like, take it as inspiration. Take it as you know, a platform to draw an emotion from, to make you go on, maybe take that styling and go in your closet and create something similar from what you have. Use it to draw something from, but don't try to like emulate it in a way where you want to be that person or you're comparing yourself to that person because it's not real. It's all make-believe. It's beautiful make-believe, but it's make-believe, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and I think knowing, coming at it from both perspectives, you see the whole team, you see how much work is involved. And now to me now, I feel like modeling is easier only because I can show up with a shoe bag. I enjoy it. I just kind of show up and people, when they hire me, they know they're getting a 6-year-old mom of two who's not going to wear a swimsuit or lingerie. I don't have to explain myself, if the pants don't fit, they just say, oh, it's okay. We'll shoot the pants later. And I don't have to worry about getting yelled at for it. And it's just a much more uplifting environment, which I really love. And I think that comes with time and age too, right? I'm not trying to make it anymore, right? I'm just enjoying where I am and helping other people kind of come up and shine the light on the other people who are doing interesting creative things.
Do you think that becoming a mum has kind of changed your perspective and your approach to the industry?
It's funny that you say that. I think not so much for myself. I was always quite a prude when it came to modeling. I did. I didn't have a swimsuit body, so I didn't have to do, I was very rectangular, much more part of beauty. So I didn't do a lot of like swimwear lingerie stuff to begin with, but my benchmark was always, can my grandmother see this image? And if my grandma couldn't see, if I wasn't going to show it to grandma, then it wasn't going to get shot. So it provided me an out a lot of the times for when something was handed to me that was see-through. It was like, oh, so what's going under this? And I would always ask in a very nice way. And usually, 10 times out of 10, they'd be like, oh, do you have a strapless you can put on under that? Or did you bring a swimsuit? It's like, of course I brought a swimsuit. Don't you worry. I'm very prepared model as well. I've learned. but it's funny now because with my kids, I don't want them, they have to choose. They have to choose that they want to model. I would never force them into it. It's their life. And it is a very interesting body image conscious industry that you're putting yourself in. And if they came to me at some point and said, Mom, I want to model, then it would be great. And here we're going to go to the top agencies. And here are the bookings that you can take. And yes, I'll help you with the photographers. And the great thing is I have such a good contact list now that I can work with, I can call up photographers and makeup artists and stylists, and we can arrange the test shoots and get that done with very little headache. Whereas for me coming up, I had no money to pay for any of these shoots. We backstart our credit cards and make it happen. I had no money, but my mom had so much faith in me that she knew it was going to come back. And it's funny because when you're starting modeling, people don't want to give you free shoots because they know they're not really going to get usable stuff because you're not going to be able to emote and you're not going to be able to sell the product. But it's only after you have kind of come up that they're like, oh yeah, we'll shoot you for free. So I'm always keen as a photographer to shoot with young girls who need images because I know how hard it was to pay for them when I was younger. But yeah, if my kids want to do it, my son or daughter wants to do it, then I'll help them out for sure. But they're gonna come from a strong foundation to know that they're already beautiful, and to know that they don't have to prove themselves, that this is just something fun, and hopefully they'll have a different mindset about it. Because for me, it was very much like, you have to make it. This is your way to succeed.
Yeah, it's kind of different pressures and different approaches, isn't it? Which is interesting because I think you touched on that just now, saying, nobody was going to shoot for free. And now look at the world that we live in, the social media world that we live in. Yeah. And, people are either demanding free stuff and offering exposure, for content. It's such a weird environment where the expectations, I guess, have kind of shifted a little bit. But then equally, like you said earlier about how when you look at a photo, so many people don't realize the amount of work and research and prep and retouching and just so much work that goes into making an image beautiful. But yet that's still the same with people's social media channels. Like, a person can go and take beautiful photos and buy a ring light and, use Photoshop for themselves and retouch it and make themselves look beautiful. I don't know whether you feel the same way, but it's always kind of like you're skipping the steps. to try, do you know what I mean? Like, you're skipping the steps of putting in that hard work to really get to a place where, for example, someone like you are now, where you actually understand the mechanics behind, like, of the whole industry as well. As someone who has come up through the traditional route and has really paid their dues and literally done a full spectrum from runway to pageants to parts, how do you feel about these Instagram models and the rise of this, I guess, trend?
Well, I think it's created a lot more inclusivity, which has been really nice to see, because coming up the traditional model route, you needed to be, you know, roughly 5'10 and a size 2 if you were a straight size model. And if you were a curve model, then it was kind of, you know, size 10 and above, really. And as a size 6 girl, there's no room for you. You either need to get bigger or smaller. And I think now, I mean, no matter who you are, you can find someone that you can relate to. And I think that's very important. Yeah, no matter what your interests are or what you look like or want to look like, you can find somebody that you can relate to on that level, whatever your value system is, whatever your hobbies are. And I think that's something very interesting, because before that wasn't portrayed in the media. You know, it was a very same kind of a girl. And now just look at the magazines now and the runway shows now. It is just, it blows my mind. It's so beautiful. And when I see old runway shows, I just think they're so boring and cookie cutter. Clothing is gorgeous, but it was just walking hangers. And now you have this like kaleidoscope of people who are really showing you how everyone can wear the clothing. No clothing is not just made for this person. It is made for everyone. And you need to find out how you like to wear it. And I think that's pretty special. I think Instagram has aided in that quite a bit, right? Because when a brand isn't on trend with that, then they know it right away. Right? Like they have comments coming up. They have DMs coming up. I talked to brands. They've gotten DMs like saying, hey, your website, it looks a little same. Could we mix things up a little bit? Like, who's buying your clothes? Why don't you talk to those people? You know? And I think that's interesting, because it's, even if the brands aren't realizing it, maybe they just, you know, they've been hiring the same models because they're friends with those models. Now they're kind of opening their eyes and saying, wow, this is a big wide world out there made of a lot of interesting people. Like, let's show that. And I think that is really lovely to have portrayed for the kids as well, because now they're able to come up and see everything in front of them and see every size and how every size is beautiful and every color is beautiful and heights and ethnicities and, you know, religions, and it's all there. And it just gives me hope that, like, you don't have to conform quite so much. You can shine, you can be yourself, whatever yourself is. And that, like, really fills me with a lot of hope for the kids coming up now, and my kids as well.
Well, speaking of, so obviously you, so when we met, you didn't have children yet. We met in Hong Kong back in 2012. Do you remember how we first met?
I was getting henna, wasn't I? We were at a Sassy yes. event, and I what I was wearing, my white shirt, and I was getting henna on my arm, and we were chatting it up, and you had fabulous accessories.
Yes, that's exactly right. We met at, Sassy Hong Kong was a media company that we both kind of worked for in different ways. So I was a sort of sub-editor or editor's assistant working there, and you were a contributor and a photographer for a lot of the events as well. And so, yeah, we went to a party or some sort of event, was it a networking event?
It was a random, I don't remember what it was at that one.
Yeah, I can't remember. I know exactly which bar it was as well.
Oh, yeah, I can remember the seat I was sitting in, the outfit I was wearing.
Yes, exactly. And yeah, we were getting henna done. And I remember, it was just meeting this glamazon girl who was so nice, so friendly, so chatty. And yeah, we hit it off straight away. And I think we then connected again shopping like a week or two later or something.
Yeah, that sounds right. That's sample sale.
Yes, exactly. All the sample sales. So we had a number of years where I guess our friendship group kind of grew, our little lipstick gang grew, and a lot of us didn't have children at the time. And then you, I think you were one of the first ones of our group who got pregnant. I mean, I know that we have obviously our other friends who came to the group, I guess, already as mums. But you were one of the first ones to get pregnant. And I remember you having a bit of a rough time with your pregnancies, to put it lightly, a bit of a rough time. You have two children now. How did you find pregnancy? I'm curious, as I guess someone who is very glamorous, who is a photographer lugging around all the equipment and also a model as well. How was pregnancy for you?
Pregnancy for me. Oh, honey. I was very lucky to get pregnant right away. So that part of the pregnancy, very grateful for. But the sickness for me was awful. So with my son, I was physically ill, face and toilet, 3 times a day, hospitalized twice. And this was for the whole pregnancy. And at the end, it was like contractions that would cause sickness, which then throwing up would cause contractions. And it was just, I was in Hong Kong at the time. And going around in the taxis in the Hong Kong streets, which are just all like winding and up mountains, I felt so bad for those taxi drivers because I had air sick bags in every purse, in every pocket, in my photography. I still have one in my photography bag. I never took out. When my friends would fly, they would bring me air sick bags and I would just be losing it in the back of the taxis. I had every ginger candy and pressure point band. I had a playlist that was devised for nauseous like patients, and you would put it in only when you were nauseous, and it was like this series of tones that would kind of calm you, like bring you down. But you couldn't listen to the playlist if you weren't sick because it could actually make you sick. So you'd literally, as soon as you'd start feeling it come on, I would be like frantically finding it. You had to have headphones in as well. They had to be earbuds. I'd be like throwing my bag at my husband and be like, get the headphones, it's happening. And oh, it was so rough. And then with my daughter, I thought, oh, everybody's like, these are different. It'll be different with your second. And it was different. It was worse, actually. I was sick up to 6 times a day with her. And then I had my son coming in 2 years old being like, ew, that's gross. Like, no one invited you in here. And yeah, but pulled a muscle with her pregnancy, started having contractions a month early.
Was that from carrying all that equipment?
I didn't shoot with her because I had just moved to Singapore. I found out I was pregnant the weekend we moved. Yeah, I think with my son, I shot pretty much up until about 8 weeks before he was born. And I stopped shooting because it got weird on set, because I would start having Braxton Hicks, like the practice contractions, right? I would have a Braxton Hicks contraction and would kind of be crouched in the corner of their house, like shooting the whole scene, and would be like, oh, okay, hold on a second. I'm good. Let's keep going. And for me, it was nothing. But for the client, they're like, oh my God, are you okay? And so the photos would just be of them like freaking out. So I kind of had to call it earlier. I thought I could just keep on shooting.
Body was telling you differently.
Yeah, it was like, okay, it's time to chill out. But you know what made me feel better was I kept up with my making the outside look good. Maybe will help the inside feel better. And I did that through quarantine and circuit breaker here. I was like, I know I'm home alone and no one is seeing me, but I feel like if I can make this feel good outside with makeup and jewelry and a nice dress, then maybe it'll help the inside. And for me, it works. It might not work for everybody, but for me, it's like, it kind of changes the chemistry a little bit. So with pregnancy, I did that as well. I'd dress up and wear the heels and have the bright lipstick and lots of jewelry. And then I would go throw up in the Starbucks bathroom. Like, just glamorous, obviously.
I actually remember, again, maybe this is just friendship's intuition or just that we knew each other that well, that we kind of suspected that you were pregnant and you hadn't announced it yet. And it was my birthday. I think it was my 25th birthday or something. I can't remember, but I had like a rooftop party and I had made a mimosa bar. But I also made a non-alcoholic one as well. And specifically for you, because I knew that out of all the friends, you were probably the only one that wasn't drinking. And you had given us some excuse, obviously. But we all kind of were like, okay, she's obviously pregnant. She's not telling us. We're just going to pretend. Like, let's just all pretend that this is just normal. Even though, of course, it was normal. That's a bad terminology. And yeah, you came around. And I remember I very subtly was just like, oh, there's ginger beer over there if you want as well. And just kind of left it at that. But interestingly, and I find this really interesting, I guess, because I'm half Chinese and we were obviously living in Hong Kong at the time. After you had your son, you did proper confinement, which if people don't know what confinement is, can you explain?
It's a lot like quarantine.
Very much like quarantine. Quarantine has gone on a little bit longer, but it is very similar. Can you explain to the listeners what confinement is, or at least what it was for you?
Okay, for me. So I had been in Hong Kong by that point like 7 years and had seen several other friends kind of outside of our circle, more like husbands, coworkers, wives and such, go through confinement, and was just really curious. It seemed like a wonderful opportunity to be home. So when you do confinement, you are home for 1 month and you basically only have warm liquids and warm foods. The idea is that when you have a baby, you lose a lot of heat. So you're supposed to be putting that heat back into your body afterwards. You don't bathe, which is the really big one that I think a lot of people get freaked out about. And you have a lot of like traditional Chinese medicines as well, cordyceps and such. And I figured, you know what, if I am going to try out confinement, I'm going to go all in. I can always scale back, but like, let's go full force. And it's only a month, right? A month is going to go by in a breeze. And also too, like I was an expat in Hong Kong. I didn't have any family around. My mom came out, I guess when Adam was probably about a week old. And my father-in-law came out as well, but you know, they were jet lagged and my mom would come to visit me. I didn't want to make her work, right? So you basically have a confinement nanny come and live with you. And they are these amazing women who basically leave their families for the month or longer, live in your home 6 days a week. And they cook all the meals, make all the teas, make the medicines. They help take care of the baby. And especially, I mean, with my first, like I was an only child. I didn't have younger brothers and sisters. I was one of the youngest out of my kind of cousin group. So I never had little ones around. And even when I babysat, the youngest kid I babysat for was 3 years old. I never had to deal with diapers or bottles or any of that. So being a mom was literally my first time being like, oh, and this is a baby. And to basically help you, right? And I needed that a lot. And Adam, he was, you know, obviously in those early days, they don't sleep much anyway, but he gave me hell with the sleeping throughout the first year. So any help I could get, I was happy to take. And I found it to be such a wonderful, nurturing month. I sat on the couch. We had like classical music playing. Some confinement nannies will say that you're supposed to rest everything. So you're not even supposed to read or watch TV. I did not go that far with it, but I did do pretty much everything. And then when it was time to bathe, about every 10 to 14 days, she would make this gigantic pot of, it was like, oh gosh, I can't remember. It smelled like Christmas was all I can remember. And it would heat you up. So you'd pour it over you. You'd sit in the bathtub on a stool and then you'd pour this concoction over you. And when I came out of the bathtub and looked in the mirror, you're supposed to have somebody there in the room with you. And she's like, oh, I'll sit with you. I'm like, you know what? I'm good. I am wearing this suit that does not look like my body right now. And the thought of having you in there with me is just a bit too overwhelming. And I came out from this first bath and I was as bright as a cherry tomato, just electric red. I was like, what's wrong with me? I'm allergic to it. And she spoke enough English to where we could get by, but it wasn't like perfect, just like my Cantonese isn't perfectly fluent. But she's like, just wait. But I'm allergic. No, wait. And I'm like, okay. And about 20 minutes later, it all went back down to normal. But the whole thing was to heat me up. And sure enough, it did. It made me bright red. It heated my whole body up. And I felt really whole and put together after confinement. I did it again with my daughter here in Singapore.
Did you? I couldn't remember if you did it with Ivy or not, but that's so interesting. What was it that was so intriguing or enticing for you to try it out? Because I think a lot of women would see the traditions that go into that. And like you said, you can't leave your house for a month. You can't bathe properly. You're eating foods that you might not be used to eating. You know, you have to like bind your belly. You don't go out to see people. Like, I mean, there's a lot of, I guess, rules that go into it that a lot of people, especially I guess in the Western world, would think, no way, I've been pregnant for long enough. I don't want to have to do this now as well. Why did you choose to do confinement?
I think having somebody take care of me. It was such a new and overwhelming experience. I had a lot of anxiety. I think I'm dealing with that. It's coming out through this year. I think everybody's dealing with something in 2020. And I am realizing that I've dealt with anxiety, and I would have panic attacks going into baby stores when I was pregnant. And I'd go into that big one in Central. I can't remember what it was called now, but I'd go into that big one and I would just back away. I couldn't even be in there. I'd have to go and sit in like a quiet room afterwards. And I didn't realize that I was having like small anxiety attacks going in there. But having a kid is such a life. It is a life-changing event. It's the biggest life-changing event you're ever going to have. And, you know, I think that I didn't know how to process that, right? And having somebody come in and just have me be still for a month. And, you know, the leaving your house thing was actually kind of nice because I didn't have to fix up. I wore like comfy dresses around the house and sweaters and socks because she wanted me to stay warm. And my friend came to visit me, and it was, I didn't feel like I was having to rush out to see anybody or get a diaper bag together and miss something and miss a feed. It was a chance to just stay home and get to know my son and get to know his rhythms and his routines and who he was and how I was changing and connecting with him. You know, my husband was now a dad, so seeing him in that role was really special. Being able to just sit on the couch with my mom for 10 days and watch movies and cuddle a baby is like a pretty amazing opportunity that you don't get to have. And then you have this wonderful, kind woman that comes in and is just there for you to help, right? And I mean, you think about like moms in the Western world, and you have, you know, especially in the US, a shorter maternity leave. Right? You're expected just to, okay, you've had a baby. Now it's time to get up and go and be your old self again. You need to lose the weight, get your body back. I think that's a lot of pressure. It's different. It's a whole other world. You're a whole other person. Your body is healing. Your brain is like going through so much with sleep deprivation and having this being that was just a part of you now outside of you, and having to really worry about somebody else for the first time on a new level. Obviously you worried about people you loved and cared about before, but I remember in the hospital, so I couldn't stand up for 4 days. I kept passing out. Nobody knew why. I had all the tests. For whatever reason, I wasn't supposed to stand up for 4 days. So I would faint when I tried. And after 4 days, I finally got to go up and go to the bathroom. And I had my son in the room and left the room. And it felt like someone had taken a piece of my physical body. I mean, obviously that's kind of what happens, but it was the first time I felt like a whole chunk of me was missing. And now I'm really worried about what's going on in that other room. And all of a sudden my heart was out walking around outside my body. Like that's what it is.
Wow.
And it doesn't get better as they get older. It just changes.
The worry stays, but it just changes form.
Yeah, it changes form, because then you're worried about, are they taking care of themselves and are they hanging out with the right people and making the right choices? And I'm sure that's going to be even worse as they age.
Already you've kind of highlighted so many things that instantaneously change the moment you have your first child or you have a child. I mean, how do you think becoming a mother has changed you? How do you think you've changed, or are you any different as a mom, do you think?
I'm definitely different. I would say I'm not as sweet, if that's a weird thing to say. That's the first thing that comes to mind. I don't wear very girl, there's always a touch of edge to my clothes now, because I feel like I had to be tougher to be a mom. I had to toughen myself up. I had to, you know, conclusively say like, this is right and this is wrong and these are the choices I'm going to make, and I have to stand by my choices. And when I have to discipline. I never had to discipline anybody before. My goodness, you know. So I'm stronger than I used to be. I am constantly amazed by how long I can go without sleep. It's been about 6.5 years now. Longer, because I didn't sleep when I was pregnant either. I feel like I'm much more open. Well, I guess I was always quite open-minded before. I'm very accepting, but I find that I have to listen more and not jump to offer advice. I just have to listen to what they have to say and what their concerns are, and then kind of say, well, what do you need? You know, do you need a hug right now? Do you want to cry? Do you want some time? And then like be where I'm needed as well. It's a wild ride, and every day you learn something new in some way. And I'm physically stronger too. Physically strong and mentally strong. And you realize like whatever's coming at you, you can handle it. I think you've got their back like nothing else. And you just realize like how you're there for somebody on such a deep level. And you'd do anything that you have to protect them. And that's so scary. Oh,
yeah, that's terrifying. That's absolutely terrifying. I obviously only kind of have a semi experience with that, I guess, being a step parent. It's a different kind of, it's the same worries but in a different way, and it's the same love but also in a different way. I'm in awe of all of you mums. I think that you guys are just absolute heroes. And I mean, on that, what's like, if we're going to stay on the theme of family and kids, so one thing that I would love to hear your perspective on is, so you obviously You're a model, you're a photographer, you're very active on social media, and your sort of professional personal life is pretty public, I guess, on your social channels, which obviously, you know, you have full control over, and it's your channel, it's your platform. And you've made a conscious decision to not share your kids' sort of faces or any distinguishable features on any of your social channels, which I think is wonderful because you do it in such a creative way that, you know, you show maybe a photo taken from behind them, or, you know, their little hands in shot, or like their feet or something, or, you know, or just, you know, you'll blur out their face. And I am really interested to know, because in the age of social media, in the age of oversharing, I guess, and living our lives online, what made you make that decision as someone who is a relatively sort of quite public on their social channel?
Well, we decided it before our first kid was born. Like, how are we going to do this? Because Instagram was already in existence, although it was new then. And Facebook obviously had been around for a few years. And just realized, like, kind of wanted the family to stay private. I grew up, like I said, I grew up modeling, right? I had my first website when I was 13. I think my uncle set up my website for me. And this was early, early days, right? Having a website in 1998 was a pretty big deal. And I had, as a model, you have to have a photo that shows your shape, right? So you have to have a swimsuit photo, even if it's a one-piece swimsuit. I think I was sitting in a diner, in a booth in a diner with a one-piece swimsuit on. But you have to show the legs, you have to show the shape, right? No matter what age you are, pretty much. So I had those pictures on there along with tons of other ones. And we'd get email through the website, and the email would go to my mom always, and she would filter it out. And if it looked like something that was a legit job, she sent it to the agency. If it was somebody that was just being polite, you know, she would correspond with them. But there was emails that came through that weren't appropriate. And I think it's interesting growing up always having people comment on your body. And I think we're all dealing with that now with social media. You're opening your world up to comments, right? To people you know, of course, and people you don't know. And not all of them are always uplifting, you know?
Yes.
I think any celebrity out there could attest to that. And I felt like my kids should be, you know, they should have their choice when they want to be public. And maybe it's not my choice to make. You know, I chose to be on social media. I chose to be a model, but they haven't chosen that. And if they want to later, then great. And I'll help them however they need. But for now, just, you know, let them kind of be there. I can't ignore that I have kids, right? Like, I can't go around on social media and just have it be me swishing around in big dresses all day and pretending like this is life. Because that's not real. Like, that's a snapshot. And it's literally a snapshot in life. But no, I'm making snacks and I'm cleaning up the kids' toys and dealing with boo-boos and, you know, and that's life too. So I feel like it's important to show them on social media because that is a part of me that makes a whole person, right? But to respect their privacy. And I have nothing against anybody that puts their kids in social media. Everybody's making their own choices and doing, you know, they might have been raised in a different place and, you know, it feels safer, or, you know, they have a private account or whatever. Or maybe they're doing it to build a brand. Like, you do you. But for our family, this is what works.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, no, I think it's definitely something that I find really interesting. I guess also because I, you know, my stepkids are getting older now, you know, they're 10 and 8, turning 9 really soon, which is crazy. And it's a whole different ball game. You know, we watched The Social Dilemma that's on Netflix. If you haven't seen, I definitely highly recommend it. And it talks about sort of how social media has kind of evolved over time. And it was both terrifying to watch it as a parent, and as an individual as well, but then equally it's kind of, it really makes you think about sort of, you know, yeah, how much are we of ourselves? Are we kind of an extension of ourselves? Are we putting out there? And I think, you know, like you said, you're kind of opening it up to, yes, wonderful things and positive things. And that's a really good thing to kind of put it out there for. But then you are also opening yourself up to unsolicited commentary or unsolicited insight into what should be, or, you know, what you think might be private, and it's actually not because you're putting it out there. So I agree with you completely. I think, you know, it's everyone's choice how they want to run their own social media or not have social media, or put their kids on there or not put their kids on there. Just, it was really interesting to kind of hear your perspective, because I think you have a really beautiful, creative way of doing that. And I guess if any women, parents out there who want to kind of know how to be able to include that, you know, include their kids, include their family life in part of that, but not overshare too much. Obviously, they know where to find you and go for inspiration.
You know, as far as what makes you a person. And for me, being a mom is the biggest part of what makes me a person. And so, you know, if you're on social media, I feel like it needs to be relatable. We've all seen these heavily curated feeds, which are gorgeous and great inspiration. But for me, you know, I still pick myself apart just like every other woman in the world does. And I found that in quarantine, those beautiful curated shots were just making me feel bad about myself. And so I had to unfollow a couple of accounts just to kind of like clear my own headspace. And I put it out there and I was like, listen, guys, I am going to take pictures because this is also a part of me. Like taking pictures and modeling, like this is something that's always been a part of being creative in my persona, but I'm not going to spend more than 2 minutes setting up for this shot. So if you see a mess in the background, it's there. And, you know, it's this, these are the clothes that I'm really wearing. These are the accessories that I'm really wearing. And while I'm dressed up, I'm also tending to a 7,000 beads that just spilled on the floor. And while we're shooting this cute picture, let's just keep going because the beads spilled and that's life too. And we'll sweep it up in a little bit. But yeah, it's, we're not perfect. We're doing the best we can, right? And I feel like you want to have a pretty shot for Instagram. That's all fine and good. I'm doing my best at that too. But all these moms are wearing so many hats. You just do your best and keep moving forward.
Do your best, keep moving forward. All forward motion counts, as you say. I love that. Cool. Well, I guess I have one final question, maybe two. One is, what life lessons do you hope to impart on your children?
Oh my goodness, that's a big one. Wow, you're really pulling out the big guns at the end here. Wow. For me, it is to be kind and be honest. And if you have to choose, be honest over being kind. Make hard choices that you can make hard choices. And sometimes, you know, the right choice is the hard one, right? I want them to know that they can do hard things, but mostly just to be a light and spread kindness and spread love, because I think the world needs so much more of that, especially right now. And, you know, so many people are so quick to judge and to comment and to, you know, we're all putting it all out there on the internet now. Just be someone's light. You know, you don't know what kind of day they're having. If you just smile at somebody on the street, say hi to the people, you know, cleaning up the streets, hold a door for somebody, whatever it is, just shine a little light in life. And you never know how far that light will reach.
I love that. I think that's really good advice that everyone can use as well. And then finally, because it is the Lipstick Gang after all, favorite lip color.
Okay. This one is a big one. So the day before all of this madness started, I went to Tom Ford, and Tom Ford holds a special place in my heart because I got to work with him and he was just flawless, a flawless human, if there is such a thing. Beautiful, beautiful man, great creative, amazing. And so I always have loved his products, and I went and I bought the fucking fabulous red lipstick. Can I curse on here? I'm not cursing, it's a brand.
Oh my God, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Then the world melted down pretty much the next day. Everybody, it started popping up on the news. Singapore started getting a bit flustered here as far as it's spreading, you know. And so I started wearing a mask pretty much the next day. And so I thought, well, this is not the right time to wear this lipstick. And I put it away, and it is in this yellow box behind me. And when the day comes where I don't have to wear a mask, I will be wearing my lipstick. So it's sitting in the box, unused, brand new, waiting for me, waiting for this amazing day that will happen where I don't have to wear a mask out and I can wear my red, gorgeous, fucking fabulous lipstick.
Oh my goodness. I mean, that in and of itself is such a great metaphor of looking ahead, and all forward motion counts. You know, it's always looking ahead and being positive. I absolutely love that. And that's it. I don't have any other questions for you. All I can say is thank you so much. You are such a beautiful friend, and I have always been super supportive of myself, of everyone that you meet, really. But you are such a light in my life, and thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm so proud of you. You're doing such good things.
Oh, thank you. All right, I'm going to stop recording.
Now.
And there you go, episode one of The Lipstick Gang, done and dusted. A huge thank you to Sabrina for taking the time out of her evening to speak with me and for being so open and honest. I love you dearly. You can follow Sabrina on Instagram at Sabrina Sikora. She really is a cheerleader in so many ways, but specifically for amazing, creative, independent brands that are sustainable and mostly women-founded. So do go and check her out. Finally, a huge thank you to you all for listening. I sincerely hope you enjoyed listening to the first episode as much as I enjoyed recording it. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify for upcoming episodes. And in the meantime, you can join our conversations on social media. The handle is at The Lipstick Gang Pod, and check out our website, thelipstickgang.com. That's it from me. Love to you all, and we'll catch up soon.